Glioblastoma. Okay. All right. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Smart Health Frontiers. Oops, Dilma was kicked out. Okay. I'm hoping we can get Dilma da Silva in. Back in. Derek, is it possible?
It seems I'm back in.
Yes, you are back in.
Am I back in? Oh
Yes.
yeah, it's wonderful. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what happened. I am trying to connect from, a spot that should be more reliable. But anyway, I'm at a conference because I'm also giving a talk very soon. Hi everyone. Good afternoon. I'm Dilma da Silva. I'm the acting assistant director for the US National Science and Foundation, Director for Computer and Information Science and Engineering. I'm so pleased to welcome you today to this symposium, Smart Health Frontiers, Driving Innovation with Fundamental Science Technology to Improve the Lives of Older Adults. So today we have three very distinguished speakers, all of whom are working at the cutting edge of biomedical technology. But before we get to the talks, I want to take a moment to emphasize how important the Smart Health Program is, the spread funds their work. We're hosting the symposium to celebrate the 10th year anniversary of the Smart Health Program. So this is a multidisciplinary collaboration between the National Science Foundation and the National Institutes of Health. The Smart Health Program is designed to accelerate innovation research in this area, bridging the gap between technological and biomedical research to help transform health and medicine in the United States. Of this process is to create sustainable partnerships with technologists and biomedical researchers so that computer scientists and engineers are engaged in the most critical biomedical questions, and that biomedical researchers are able to take full advantage.
Oh, sorry. What just happened? Still.
She disappeared.
Oh, no. See the importance of networking in this world. High quality networking is essential. Maybe type your questions in Smart Health Correspondence. Do we have her back?
So I am back, Wendy, but I think the most wise thing is that you take over, please. Not sure what is going on here with my 5G hotspot. So let me just finish up saying that this is really important, an important program. And I think by showing case these three amazing talks, you'll get a flavor of what this program has been accomplishing over the last 10 years. So Wendy, please, keep the end the description and please introduce our three very distinguished speakers today.
All right. Well, thank you, Dilma. And I would ask that I think our sign language folks got kicked out too. So if we could get our translators back in, that would be fabulous. So I just want to say that we're really excited about this. And as Dr. Da Silva was saying, this bridges the gap between the technological and biomedical research communities to help transform the health and medicine in the United States. So a key component of this process is to create sustainable partnerships between technology researchers and biomedical researchers to ensure the research done by computer scientists and engineers is targeting the most critical biomedical questions, and that biomedical researchers are available to take, they can take full advantage of the advances in this science. So as I'm sure you're all aware, artificial intelligence and other technological advances are poised to make widespread changes in multiple sectors of the American society, yet the integration of these advancements has been slow in health-related fields. So today's symposium showcases three amazing projects which are using advancements in technology to improve the lives of older adults who experience chronic health conditions at a much higher rate than other age groups. With the percentage of older adults in the United States projected to grow, the ensuing strain on the healthcare system underscores the urgency for innovative solutions. Our speakers today will discuss how advances in computer science can contribute to the management of a variety of aging-related illnesses and impairments. So I'm going to move to our next slide and introduce our first speaker. So our first speaker is John Stankovich, and Dr. Stankovich is the BP America Professor Emeritus in Computer Science Department at the University of Virginia, and he was the director of the School of Engineering Link Lab. He's received too many awards that are too numerous to mention, but I will say he's gotten the Distinguished Achievement Awards, and he's just an amazing researcher. He's a prolific author and is frequently cited by other scholars and has over 68,000 citations to his work. He's going to present on learning and improving Alzheimer patient and in-home caregiver relationships via smart healthcare technology. Dr. Stankovich.
All right, thank you, Wendy. So rather than restating what was just read as the title, I just want to highlight that this is about helping the caregiver of Alzheimer's patients. There's a lot of work on helping the patients themselves, but much less on the caregiver. And it's collaborative between Ohio State, Virginia, and Tennessee. It requires the expertise by different areas, such as myself there, as Stankovic, as an expert in sensing systems and some areas of machine learning, Hongming Wang, expert in reinforcement learning, Karen Rose, who's worked with dementia patients for decades. She's from a nursing school, and Christina Gordon in psychology, where we need to make recommendations to caregivers to help them reduce their stress. And she works with behavioral science. Okay, next slide. One quick slide on motivation. There are over 6 million Americans living with Alzheimer's, and projections by 2060, it'll be close to 14 million. And in particular, what's sometimes forgotten is there's over 11 million Americans serving as informal caregivers, and they themselves often get sick. You know, they're worried, they get angry, conflict, stress, and this reduces their own health quality. So let's not forget the caregivers. All right, so to go next slide. So I've used this slide as a brief overview of what we did. And so if you look there at the patient, an elderly man sitting in a chair has Alzheimer's, maybe his daughter is helping him at home and experiences anger and conflict. If you follow the arrow around, we have a microphone in the environment. The microphone's job is to be very, very passive, and so that the people can go about their lives in the way they normally do. And there is a four-stage pipeline in dealing with the microphone outputs, but what's important is that we're looking for this anger, conflict, stress, and so on through voice. So we have to employ machine learning. Then if we find that the person is angry or in conflict, then we invoke the reinforcement learning to develop various recommendations and have adaptive recommendations. That's where that computer-like chip is there. And then it sends that information down to a smartphone to interact with the caregiver and giving recommendations how to reduce the stress. And this is learned over time and get feedback back and forth from the caregiver. I'm not going to talk about the cloud and any of that. We only have 15 minutes. And I think what's important is we actually implemented this, put it in 11 homes, And each deployment lasted a full 4 months. So that's kind of, I think, very important as well. Next slide. So since this is NSF, I wanted to focus on some of the scientific questions that we worked on and that was informed by the medical problem. And so the first one is, you know, how can we build passive sensing systems to detect negative emotions? And this is complicated because it has to work in the presence of household noise, in particular TV, where there's lots of voices on the TV and some people have their TV on all day, air conditioners and many other. The microphone is somewhere in the room, so it picks up the speaker's voices from different amplitudes. The different environments have different reverberation content, and so it causes differences in the processing of the voice. And the context changes over time. You can't just train it just for a particular situation. They might buy a new couch, put new drapes in, and so on. And so it's very complicated. Next slide. So in the speech processing part of the voice, we have this acoustic signal coming in, and it's actually a four-stage pipe, and I'm showing just two stages here. One is to identify the speaker, and it uses a neural net, and we're worried about the caregiver, so we want to understand it's the caregiver and not the patient, or vice versa, and whether there's guests or the TV is on, and so on. And then the bottom neural net there looks for different moods like angry, conflict, and so on. And both of these require novel solutions, which we have papers on. I want to emphasize that, without being able to go into details, that to detect anger, we have a novel architecture of a CNN combined with outer data distribution techniques. And for conflict, we have it's actually complicated architecture that uses generative adversarial network type style to detect conflicts. Next slide. So another question is, you know, how and when do we intervene to mitigate these negative emotional states? Again, this is a very complex problem, and we need the nursing partners to help us understand exactly what dementia patients are like and how they change over different stages and so on. And we also need experts in behavioral science so that we can implement these various techniques that we would use the reinforcement learning to actually decide what to recommend to the patients. Next slide. So the different We develop the recommendations into different categories, which I list here, which you can read. And this is what the reinforcement learning techniques will understand and learn about what works for a different person. And so the adaptive part is very important because it even changes over time, over the 4 months. And we found that this encouraging words in the morning is actually very, very valuable. It's actually more valuable than most of the other ones. Next slide. So the solution we developed was called contextual bandit federated learning. So the contextual part has to do with the idea of we need to understand what time of day it is, what different emotions that people are feeling, and so on. And we would make different recommendations based on that. The banded part is the reinforcement learning strategy. And then the federated learning is because we can collect information from different families and potentially even use knowledge from other families to help a particular family. And this also is very complicated because most of federated learning does not deal with heterogeneous clients. So each of our clients has a different reward system. There's privacy issues, so we want to keep the data local in the individual client's laptops and not share it in the cloud. There's asynchronous updates, which is also not common. There's very amounts of data per client. Some clients need a lot of recommendations, others don't need so many. And our paper also does some technical things about proving upper bounds on what's called accumulated regret and its trade-off with respect to communication costs. Next slide. And just a brief inkling of some of the data we're getting in terms of the findings with respect to the recommendations. So on the left, there's CG2, caregiver two, and it seems like that person turns out that they're not really liking mindful activities. They don't like those and don't use those. While CG3 on the right-hand side really likes mindful activities. And so this is kind of known, but the understanding it and developing it for, and making sure it's adaptive for the individuals. Next slide. Another scientific question really has to do with privacy. Most of the time I present this, people always ask questions. So obviously privacy is a function of personal preferences, different psychological and emotional issues people are going through, and one, we do need technical support to achieve it. So next slide. Mm-hmm. So privacy, I wanna break it into two parts. The first is at recruiting time, the second is during deployments. So at recruiting time, we out of the first 100 people we tried to recruit, this 68 rejected the study. Right, and the reasons are shown here for their primary reason of rejecting it. And so worried about privacy issue in bold there, 25% of people said that. So it's still an important issue, obviously, but it's not the only one. Now, next slide. So if you go to deployment time, what can we do during deployment to help with privacy and how will users react to that? So basically we implemented a strategy of many things, including users can set their start and end time for the system. So let's say it could be from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. or 3 p.m. to midnight. And they can change that easily. They can turn off the system just by hitting a button on the phone and they can turn it back on whenever they want. Also any voices from non-registered speakers are not recorded. And you know, we explain that to them and how that works. The content of speech is not recorded. This was one of the main things that seemed to ameliorate their problems with privacy and say that we're only looking in things like tone and pitch, and we show them wiggly lines showing that here's the acoustics, it looks like this, this is what we're collecting, not the words. And we even show that to them at various meetings we have with them over time. And data is not shared across users through that reinforcement learning technique. Next slide. And so with privacy, it turned out that all 11 dyads said that there was privacy was not a problem by the end of the study. They had concerns in the beginning and as we were going through, but at the end, I think they saw the value of the system versus the privacy issue. Next slide. Overall, I don't want to go through this, I won't have time, but we are seeing things like on the left, the various positive experiences. And I think two I want to just point out is one is the box that says being conscious of stress. Just having the system there, having the recommendation coming and making people aware that they are under stress, they do are in conflict or having, and they do claim that the system helped relax them. And on the right, we try to, in some ways, stress negative things and pull negative issues out. And here again, I'm not going to go through all of them, but the two that I want to mention is they still felt the system was time consuming. Many of these caregivers are just swamped with time, and any little thing even that adds something extra to do makes them feel like they're overworked. And sometimes stress is not related to caregiving, but we didn't really have a way of recognizing stress versus caregiving versus stress not, but I think we can probably do it. Next slide. I want to make one more comment is that most of this work was done during COVID. And so we weren't allowed to meet with people or bring systems to people's homes. So we developed, which I think a very interesting and novel result. We can box up our system and mail it. And the caregiver just takes it out of the box and they're able to put it together. Caregivers that have no technical experience. And they were able to do it on average, these 11 deployments took them about an hour, 1.3 hours. And the value is that we now can recruit nationwide. You don't have to have people that are within driving distance of your students or with driving distance of the anyone who's going to deploy your system. And not only that, it also is much more robust. and it makes the system work and run for in a much, much better way. So a lot of these techniques can be used post COVID-19. Okay, next slide. So finally, next steps. I do think we can detect stress a little bit better with using physiological parameters, but the problem with this is then now you're requiring them to wear, say, a smart watch, and they may or may not do that, and so that's a trade-off. We do feel like we try to develop solutions that at development time are so robust that they're going to work when we deploy them, but that isn't always work. And how do we build a new methodology for doing that that similar to things like civil engineering? They know how to put together as strongly as possible a development of a solution for a new bridge, and then they put the bridge up and it most of the time stands up, or almost always. And I think the adaptive personalization could still be used, could be enhanced and improved over time. Okay, next slide. And this is just the list of the people from the three universities that contributed most to this project. Thank you.
Thank you. That was a fabulous presentation. Again, if people have questions, there's an email on the screen now, sch-correspondence@nsf.gov. Please send your questions to that email address and we'll get them to the speakers. So thank you so much. So our next speaker is Laurel Reich, and Dr. Reich is a professor of computer science and engineering at the University of California, San Diego. She also has appointments in the Department of Emergency Medicine, Contextual Robotics Institute, and the Design Lab. So Dr. Reich directs the Healthcare Robotics Lab and leads research in human-robot teaming, assistive robotics, embodied AI, and health informatics, and builds intelligent systems with work with proximity with people. Dr. Reich's current research projects have applications in acute care, neurorehabilitation, and home health, and further health equity through community-driven research efforts. Dr. Reich has received way too many awards to note from NSF and other agencies, as well as multiple best paper awards. Dr. Reich will be presenting cognitively assistive robots for people with mild cognitive impairment. Dr. Reich?
Thanks very much, and thanks for the introduction. It's really great to be here today. So I work on technology that is really key on supporting disabled people and their families. Could you do next slide, please? Yeah, thanks. We also do work, which I'll mostly be talking about today, we also do work that supports the clinical workforce, including clinicians, community healthcare workers, and professional caregivers. And we take a health equity and human-centered approach in all of our work, where we center the voices and ideas of people who are historically excluded from technology development to ensure that any systems we create are well-aligned with their needs and reflective of their ideas. Next slide, please. So the act of care work, which means supporting others and supporting oneself, is undervalued. People who engage in care work are overworked and underpaid, and many live below the poverty line, unable to make ends meet. What's worse is how invisible all of this work is. Care workers do so much to keep others afloat, but they're often taken for granted. A really nice paper by Joy Ming and colleagues draws attention to this invisibility and critically examines the role technology plays or fails to play in addressing this. They highlight the complex dynamics and nature of care work and how adding technology risks exacerbating these social ills. Next slide, please. So given this question, one big context is why AI, why robots? A lot of technologists frame things around care gaps and how AI is going to solve all these problems, it's going to augment human care work, it's going to empower disabled people, and so on. But ultimately, these sentiments fall flat when you start to ask the why questions. Why are there care gaps? Why is there a shortage of care workers? Why is their work being undervalued? Why do disabled people face so many barriers to access and care? Once you start to learn the answers to these questions, you begin to realize the problem is systemic and societal. We don't value disabled people, and we don't value those who provide care work. Next slide, please. So AI is basically a band-aid. It is not going to fix these major systemic and societal problems other than itself. It's going to potentially be creating a lot more. However, we are at an excellent inflection point to pause and reflect on how we develop and use AI, and how to consider if, when, and how it can support caregivers and disabled people. Next slide, please. When we connect with the communities we want to work in, when we bring them into the research and development process, when we give them ownership of technology design, when we center their voices and ideas, we have a much better chance of getting to where we want to go. Next slide, please. For many years, my students and I have been working closely with people with dementia and mild cognitive impairment, their care partners, and clinicians to envision the future of dementia care. We've been particularly motivated by questions of access. We explore how we can use technology to extend the reach of clinical and social services, and how we can design accessible and effective robot and AI-delivered health interventions. And we explore how to do this in a way that reflects the goals of our community partners. Next slide, please. So as we've heard, MCI and dementia affects approximately 50 million people worldwide, and it will affect approximately 131 million people by 2050. So MCI, which is a prodromal stage between regular aging and dementia, can affect a person's cognitive abilities, ranging from mild symptoms such as reduced concentration and challenges with prospective memory in the early stages, to the inability to engage in instrumental and functional activities of daily living in the later stages. People with MCI and dementia require personalized and unique interventions to support their health and independence. There's currently no known cure or effective treatment for MCI or dementia, but there are behavioral and lifestyle interventions that can effectively slow the progression of the disease. And there are many things we can do to improve quality of life and support care partners in the later stages. So we've been developing robots to support people across the spectrum. MCI, we've been working with people with MCI and with clinicians to develop Carmen, a physically embodied robot that can deliver a practice-based and evidence-based intervention for MCI. Next slide, please. We've also been working with people with advanced dementia and care partners to design robots that can make life more fun and enjoyable. We can't cure anything and we're not trying to. Our aim is to provide enrichment and to improve quality of life. Today, I'll mostly be focusing on Carmen and people with MCI, but I'll briefly discuss our other work at the end. Next slide, please. The intervention we use on Carmen is CCT, or compensatory cognitive training. It teaches people metacognitive strategies to help strengthen cognitive functioning and minimize the impact of impairment on their daily lives. For example, we might encourage someone to make a habit of placing their keys next to the door when they return home, or using strategies such as visual imagery to compensate for memory difficulties. Next slide, please. We're adapting CCT to be delivered by physically embodied robots. The inspiration here is that robots can extend the reach of an intervention. And this is the theme across many of our projects, that the robot can help with the homework between sessions with a clinician to reinforce concepts at home. We hope that one day we can extend this work to the point where the robot chiefly delivers the intervention to help to expand its reach. Now, you might ask, why a robot? Why not an app? Well, something that we found both in our own work, as well as by a number of other people in the field, is that there's something unique about a robot's physical embodiment that helps people engage with it when it delivers intervention and sustain working with it, much more so than an app. Next slide, please. So how do we translate an intervention, which we know works well in a clinical setting, onto a robot to be delivered at home? We know long-term interaction leads to better adherence and outcomes, but how do we do this for people with MCI who have unique requirements? For example, they can be easily frustrated or overly stimulated. We conducted some formative research to explore this in concert with our clinical collaborators and with people with MCI. And this yielded a number of helpful design considerations for designing robots for people with MCI and design patterns for how to translate clinic-based interventions into the home. Next slide, please. One of our most striking findings was how clinicians emphasize rewarding a person's perseverance over their performance, and as they might not necessarily show improvement throughout an intervention. So here, a robot could reward users for behaviors such as maintaining a streak or for trying out new strategies. Next slide, please. It's also important to connect the intervention to the real world so that people can transfer what they've learned into their everyday lives. Clinicians might ask people to reflect on opportunities where they can practice a cognitive strategy, such as remembering names at a social gathering or a grocery list. Robots could also employ similar strategies. Next slide, please. It's also important to include a person's interests in an intervention to make it enjoyable. Robots could do this, for example, by leveraging games or books that a person enjoys to make things more interesting. Next slide. It's also important to help people set intervention goals to help them be more aware of its impacts. So generally, clinicians will work really closely with people to set very achievable goals. And a robot could facilitate this by asking users to reflect on their cognitive concerns and helping them to identify potential solutions. Next slide, please. Finally, it's very important to make robots cognitively accessible to people with MCI by minimizing cognitive demand. This can be achieved by keeping intervention content simple and succinct and organizing information logically to help users maintain focus. Similarly, repeating information can help users review the material, so it's important to reiterate important points and ask people if they'd like anything to be repeated. Next slide, please. So we've used these findings to develop our robot Carmen, which is the cognitively assistive robot for motivation and neurorehabilitation. Carmen delivers compensatory cognitive training over time and autonomously to people with MCI at home. It gives people with MCI an opportunity to practice compensatory strategies, such as remembering lists of words like grocery lists or using a calendar or engaging in note-taking. Carmen's based on the open source robot platform Flexi, which was developed by colleagues at the University of Washington. And we made a number of modifications to the hardware, and we also wrote all of the software from scratch. Next slide, please. So Carmen uses a content controller to determine what intervention content to give to a person and how it should behave while delivering that content. It then considers a person's responses via tablet and speech and adjusts its behavior accordingly. For example, if a person completes an activity and performs poorly, Carmen might give them encouragement, whereas it might celebrate if they performed well. At the end of the day, the robot sends interaction data it collected to a database, and each night we have a machine learning system that can adjust Carmen's behavior to prepare for the next session. Next slide, please. So I'd like to show you a brief demo of Carmen teaching one of these CCT strategies to a participant in their home. This was during a week-long deployment of the robot. And you can play the video, please. Oh, I'm not sure if there's audio.
Let's try it again.
It can be helpful to have a notes section in your planner where you can quickly take notes throughout your day. Let's practice note-taking. We'll play the color game to practice note-taking.
All right. Sorry.
Okay. Great job. You remembered five colors when practicing note-taking.
Great. Next slide, please.
The number one way to...
So we ran a feasibility study first with clinicians and then with people with mild cognitive impairment. And each used the robot for 1 week, and they also completed a companion workbook, which the robot instructed them on how to use. We collected a number of measures, including several questionnaires, usage data, and we also conducted semi-structured interviews with participants to understand their impressions, their expectations, and their experiences using Carmen. We learned a lot of interesting things, which I'll summarize briefly for brevity. Next slide, please. Participants with MCI expressed their willingness to try strategies with Carmen that they previously wrote off as impossible. For example, after learning the overlearning strategy with the robot, participants talked about using it to help remember information for a class they were taking. They also talked about using the note-taking strategy to remember names and using the mindfulness strategy to de-stress. This was really exciting given that our clinical participants said that even if people with MCI decided not to incorporate every strategy in their lives, just learning and using a few new habits can lead to marked changes in cognition. Next slide, please. Participants said that they wanted Carmen to exhibit greater degrees of autonomy. So, for example, they wanted the robot to be more involved and provide greater support when completing their CCT activities. This was really interesting and raises questions on how much autonomy we want the robot to have versus how much clinicians might want participants to do the work on their own. Next slide, please. Our clinical participants talked about translating Carmen to other populations. For example, maybe it could support children with ADHD, where the child could complete activities with the robot before unlocking screen time. The flexibility of Carmen's system design enables extending its use quite easily, so we're very excited about exploring applications like this. Next slide. In future work, we might explore using wearables and privacy-preserving IoT sensors to detect real-world strategy usage. So for example, a user could remember their keys when they left the house, and Carmen could provide praise or encouragement and help connect the dots between the intervention and the real world. Next slide. So very briefly, I want to talk about the work that we're doing at the other end of the spectrum, which is supporting people with late-stage dementia and their care partners. This work is much more exploratory. We're starting with the community first, and then we're building technology outward. Unlike the prior project with Carmen, we don't have an intervention, and we don't necessarily expect to have one. Instead, by engaging in collaborative work with community partners, we can start to understand what the shape of future technologies in this space might look like. Next slide. So another thing about dementia is it can lead to isolation and a loss of agency as the disease progresses. Next slide. Informal caregivers provide the majority of this support, but as I mentioned earlier, they're overburdened by a huge lack of social and financial support. Next slide. So researchers across a lot of disciplines are exploring ways to support both populations. A lot of researchers in this space adopt a critical dementia lens, which examines dementia's social construction to understand embodied expressions of personhood. And in public health, researchers explore how social determinants of health can impact health equity, both for caregivers and for people with dementia, and explore methods to address them. Our work explores the intersection of these two approaches to dementia care and explore how we can design technologies that promote agency for people with dementia and alleviate caregiver burden, and how we can incorporate community healthcare practices into dementia technology design to advance health equity. Next slide. So we've been adopting these research lenses into our collaborations with dementia community healthcare workers, dementia care partners, and people with advanced dementia. And we've explored a lot of different research questions and are starting to triangulate on some key concepts for how to design technologies that can support people with advanced dementia and care partners. For example, we've learned a lot about how technologies can help support interactions between care partners and people with dementia to support joy and laughter and fun and engagement. Our care partners have built robots that support them in times of difficulty, but also in times of joy, and thought about ways to help them reconnect with their loved ones. We've been exploring how robots can be designed to help to affirm agency, not expecting people with dementia to rely on their memory, but rather to support more casual interactions that affirm their personhood. We've tackled questions like how technologies can support emotional well-being and task assistance and promote sensory experiences such as music and touch, something well-preserved in later stages of dementia. And finally, we've been thinking about what it means for robots to reflect and mirror people's personalities, act as a listener and act as a student, to draw on a person's wisdom rather than being a fire hose of information, and what that means for robot design. These perspectives and designs are coming from our community partners, thus we're hopeful that we're on the right track as we move forward in our work. So next slide, please. So to wrap up, I talked about our collaborative work with people with MCI, care partners and clinicians to design and develop future technologies like Carmen that deliver clinic-based neurorehabilitative interventions for people with MCI in their homes. I've also discussed our other work designing technologies with people with advanced dementia and with their care partners. Our hope is that these technologies can help to extend the reach of interventions and also to help bring community care practices into the home and overall improve the experience of MCI and dementia for all. Last slide. I'd like to thank our community partners, my students, and our sponsors, especially NSF. And I thank you for your attention, and I look forward to your questions later.
Thank you so much. Our final speaker, last but definitely not least, is Aktef Chapara, who's a professor in the Department of Computer Science at the University of Iowa. His research interests lie at the intersection of systems, networking, and machine learning. His interdisciplinary research aims to develop novel methods to evaluate, optimize, and personalize hearing aids. He has received many awards, including the Test of Time Award at Census in 2022, and has had multiple Best Paper Awards. Dr. Chapara is going to present towards personalizing hearing amplification.
Next slide. Thank you very much, Wendy, for the introduction. It is a pleasure to talk about some of the work that I have been doing with my collaborators on personalizing hearing aids. Next slide. Let us start by considering the prevalence of hearing loss to get an understanding of how important this problem is. If we are looking at the United States, about 1 in 6 adults reports having some trouble hearing. In the aggregate, this amounts to about 37.5 million Americans who suffer from hearing loss. Next slide. If we project this worldwide, the World Health Organization projects that about 1 in 4 people are going to have some problem hearing by 2050. The increase in the prevalence of hearing loss is primarily driven by an increase of the age of the population. If we are looking at the impact that hearing loss has on people, hearing loss tends to shrink our worlds. It really has a profound impact on our quality of life. Research studies have shown that it can be associated with social isolation, anxiety, depression. Fortunately, we do have interventions that tend to be quite effective. We have hearing aids that are very effective at dealing with hearing loss, particularly for the elder population, and as well as cognitive issues. The reality, though, is that even though we have these interventions that are available, they are not as widely deployed as we would like them to be. Even in the United States, only about 1 in 4 people over the age of 20 who could actually benefit from using a hearing aid actually use them. There are many factors that contribute to this situation. Three of the more important ones are, well, first of all, they tend to be quite expensive. If you buy a hearing aid, it costs about $2,500 when they come bundled with visits to the audiologist. Speaking of audiologists, well, we don't have enough of them, particularly in rural regions of the United States. And despite our best engineering efforts, still a significant fraction of our users tend to be unsatisfied with the performance of hearing aids, particularly in noise conditions. One of the things that I'm really excited about is the recent approval of the FDA. Next slide, Wendy. The recent approval of the FDA for over-the-counter hearing aids. And one of the reasons that I'm really excited about these devices is because they come at a much lower cost than traditional hearing aids. Unfortunately, the reason why they come with this lower cost is because they come with no visits to the audiologist. It is up to the end user to configure how they amplify sounds and to make the best out of them. At the University of Iowa, we have developed various methods to do over-the-counter personalization. But before I present some of our work, I want to go through the traditional method that the audiologist would go about to fit hearing aids. So the first step that audiologists typically do is to perform a hearing test And the result of that hearing test is an audiogram that assesses how well a person hears in different frequency bands. Once they have this audiogram, they use what is called a fitting rationale, such as null NL2, to determine what is the initial configuration of the hearing aid. This configuration defines how sounds are amplified. Over several visits back to the audiologist, this configuration is then refined based on the feedback from the user to better meet their hearing needs. Next slide. So at a very high level, one of the way that hearing aids work is that they take the incoming sound and they divide it in multiple frequency bands or channels. And each one of these channels is amplified by a given gain. These gains are determined by the amount of hearing loss that a subject can have. Next slide. However, usually you don't really only get one number. You actually get a number that changes depending on the how loud the sounds are. So if you have soft sounds, usually the gains tend to be higher. If the sounds get too loud, then the gains are reduced to maintain the comfort of the subject. The take-home message from this slide is, here I'm showing a hearing aid that uses only three channels, but in reality, a hearing aid can use anywhere from 6 to 8 channels, resulting in a large space of possible configurations that we need to pick among. Next slide. So if we are to be able to support users tuning their over-the-counter hearing aids, we need to come up with methods that enable them to do three key things. One of them is to navigate this large space of possible configurations. They need to find the one configuration that meets their individualized hearing needs. And we need to expose to them user interfaces that allow them to provide feedback to us about what are their preferences. Next slide. At the University of Iowa, we have developed an approach to tuning and personalizing over-the-counter hearing aids. Our solution is data-driven and based on machine learning. The way that we consider this problem is we start with population statistics about the characteristics of hearing loss. And then we identify a population of users that we want to target with an over-the-counter hearing aid. Then what we do is that we account for their individual preferences. We take this large space of possible configurations and discretize them to a small number of presets that we expose to users via user interfaces to choose among. In the following, I will provide some additional details about this process. Next slide. So if you remember when I introduced the process of that audiologists use to prescribe hearing aids, I mentioned that they use a fitting rationale called null NL2 that takes in an audiogram and maps that audiogram to a hearing aid configuration. It turns out that if two people have similar audiograms, unsurprisingly, they have very similar hearing aid prescriptions. This can be a problem because the audiograms do not fully characterize the hearing loss of people. And it also is a problem because each user has a subjective assessment of how they prefer sounds to sound like. So what we have done at Iowa is that we have developed methods that take in an average hearing aid configuration, and we have augmented those those possible configurations to think about what are the possible deviations from that configuration that are present for users with similar hearing loss. Next slide. Using all these configurations that account for the variability of users and also how hearing loss varies within a population, we use genetic algorithms to try to identify a small subset of presets, discrete configurations that are good enough for a large number of people within our target population. One of the very interesting results that we are obtaining is that a small number of presets are actually sufficient to meet the needs of a significant fraction of the users that we are considering. So for example, when we are considering a population with mild to moderate hearing loss, we can satisfy the needs of those users using approximately 30 presets and cover 80% of the users. Now that we have these very few presets, we can present them to the user. And we have looked at various user interfaces that we can expose to the user. We have considered a user interface that is based on pairwise comparison, where the feedback from the user is, do you prefer A? Do you prefer B? And this feedback is fed into a machine learning algorithm that it can help identify what is the best configuration for the user within a small number of pairwise comparisons. Next slide. Similarly, there are other types of user interfaces that one can develop. And here we have used dimensionality reduction techniques to take this large space of configuration and project it into two dimensions. And then we provide users with a slider-based user interface to navigate this two-dimensional space. Next slide. I am very excited about the work that we have done, but I'm even more excited about some of the future opportunities that they are available to us. We are considering two different directions to push our work on over-the-counter hearing aid personalization. One is what we are calling shallow hearing aid personalization, where we are trying to extend the reach of personalizing hearing aids without specifically changing the signal processing algorithms that are used by hearing aids. We are specifically interested in how can we personalize other aspects such as noise reduction or beamforming, and moving from just focusing on the act of the initial configuration of the device to support continuous refinement. We are interested in developing user interfaces that are context sensitive and goal oriented. And those will be one of the things that we'll be focusing in our research. The other really exciting direction is the opportunity to perform much deeper personalization by replacing the current signal processing algorithms with deep neural networks. There is already some work done in this area. However, traditionally people have been looking at audiometric measurements to drive this fitting process. In contrast, we are looking at using EEG measurements that better capture brain processing and use that feedback for training the DNS. Next slide. I want to thank all my collaborators and students that have participated in this project. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks to all of our speakers. I just we have some questions, so I'm gonna start with our questions. And actually, Dr. Chaparro, I'll start with yours. Amplification only works for some types of hearing loss. The distortion's a complex issue. Do you have a way to address distortions?
We don't have a foolproof way of handling distortion. We are working on better ways on quantifying the impact of distortions and the trade-off that people have between how much distortion we introduce and their personal preferences. So for example, some people would like to have longer delays in processing, but lower artifacts, whereas other people would prefer much shorter delays and latency in signal processing, but also lower quality in denoising.
Great, thank you. And now I have a question for all three, and I'll let you start. People wondering, how did you recruit participants for this, and what's the major motivation for the study participation? Dr. Stankovich, do I start with you?
Sure. So we actually recruited primarily initially through a dementia center at Ohio State, but then because of COVID, we actually went online and used social media to recruit. And different kinds of social media. And the motivation really was that caregivers are overwhelmed and they need help and they know they need help. And when this study was first introduced, I got so many calls, people saying, can I have this system now? Can I have this system now? So that if they feel like they can improve their lives and reduce their stress, that's their motivation.
Thank you. Dr. Reich.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. We get a lot of calls from people that are really excited about the potential for these robots to be supportive. You know, everywhere from people with at the MCI stage to those with advanced dementia. Definitely, caregivers, care partners are really, informal caregivers are really excited about this and this work, and also professional caregivers as well. I'm just looking for more ways to help with people's engagement, ways to consider new, we've been working a lot with our collaborators on thinking about ways to support new activities that can be engaged with. And that's been really exciting. I think we've really learned a lot from these collaborations. We've spent about 8 years building these very strong community ties, and we've been really fortunate to have these collaborators that have given us so many ideas.
Great, thank you. And Dr. Chaparro.
Yeah, we are really lucky here to have a very good communication sciences and disorder department that I collaborate with. And lots of our subjects come from a local registry of people with hearing loss. Everybody is really excited to participate in research and lend their time for us to try to develop better methods to improve sound amplification.
Thank you. Dr. Stankovich, I have one for you. How do you assess and ensure accuracy of the system's speech categorization, knowing that it's actually an angry voice?
Yes, this is a very good question and complicated. The idea that most of the time people develop these models based on data sets and then they test them and then they deploy them. And once they deploy them, they have no idea of what's really true. One option is to have an EMA-like system where you ask the caregiver, in our case, were you angry at this point? And they would say yes or no. So they consider ground truth the caregiver. However, this is a good example of needing behavioral psychologists and dementia experts, because it's clear that many times people do not recognize their own emotions. So that the caregiver, when they say they're, no, I wasn't angry, were they really? So we were able to take, in addition, the audio clips that were really there where our algorithm said they were angry, and then what did the caregiver say, and then label them after the fact as well. So now we have three different areas of assessment, and we find all sorts of mixed results that you know, our algorithm says they're angry, the person says no, and the labelers say yes, and all different combinations. And so we're really studying this carefully now and trying to understand what we can learn from the fact that we now have these multiple ways of identifying the accuracy. And I think we're still far from having, highly accurate algorithms.
Thank you. And so I want to say we're at the end of our time, and I want to say thank you. And I think this has been such a wonderful example of how the foundational science is really enhancing what these important societal problems, which, you know, hearing and cognition and caregiver stress, you know, these are, you know, and dementia, these are really important societal issues. And I think you all have given us such great examples of how the NSF science is driving that forward in partnership with our biomedical community. So with that, I'm going to say thank you. This is the first of our Frontier series. So look forward to more later this year. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.